The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
You have three big actors that are involved in meddling in elections, meddling in democratic institutions, yet the response is strictly national. So what we need is to dramatically increase the amount of cooperation. And NATO is a pre-digital era security organization. Distance has become irrelevant. You can attack countries around the world instantaneously and regardless of distance. NATO is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization because it's based on sort of fighter plane range, bomber range, but it doesn't matter anymore. Distance in this kind of war has lost its importance, so there's no reason why Japan, South Korea, New Zealand, Australia shouldn't be involved in an alliance that would share information about these kinds of things. But I think that as more democracies come under threat, this is, may be a way to go.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 17th, 2018. Tomas Ilves was president of Estonia from 2006 to 2016. He is the only head of state who has ever been a guest on the Lawfare podcast, and he's back. Megan Reese of the R Street Institute and I sat down with him at Stanford, where he is now a distinguished senior fellow at the Hoover Institute. We talked about collective defense of liberal democracies. We talked about cybersecurity. We talked about the digitization of Estonia. And we talked about presidential tweeting by our president and Estonia's. It's the Lawfare Podcast, not sure which episode, Tomas Ilves on the situation. Let's start with Twitter. We in the United States have this perception that a president who mans his own Twitter account is A, a novelty of Donald Trump, and B, a horrible, dangerous, scary thing. But some of us remember that before Donald Trump was president and manned his own Twitter feed, there was a country in Europe that had a president who manned his own Twitter feed. And some of us interacted with that Twitter feed and found it quite lovely that a head of state would actually interact with people by Twitter. And for those listeners who haven't figured it out yet, that was you. So I'm interested in how you came to the idea that as president, it made sense for you to have a Twitter account that you would manage by yourself, and how it makes you feel now to watch that idea become this kind of Frankenstein's monster of Donald Trump's Twitter feed.
Well, first, I followed Twitter just simply because it was a more effective way of keeping up with the news than to go through the New York Times, the Financial Times, Washington Post, I mean, various newspapers. And I found that if I followed my favorite reporters, as soon as they posted something, I would see it there. So it was just a little more up to date, and it was actually more efficient. And I think that's one reason why journalists in general are on Twitter, is that it is a more efficient way of keeping up with news, and you follow the reporters you're interested in and the topics, people who would write about the topics that you're interested in. And so that was, first of all, just a source of information. And in the beginning, I just simply retweeted things that I found interesting, but every once in a while, I would begin to comment on what I read, and I've been doing that since then. And of course, I think we began to interact via Twitter because I would send you bad puns.
Yes, and because we interacted because I was writing about the Estonian digital residency program.
Right.
And then I tried to get you to endorse my proposal to fight Putin, but you wisely, as a frontline state head of state, stayed away from that one.
Well, I mean, in office, I mean, there are places one should not go. I mean, I think I kind of cross the line every once in a while, but not generally.
So, first of all, to what extent did your Twitter feed cause consternation in the Estonian bureaucracy? Was there a sense that this was in any way a problem? And what were the benefits of it to you as a politician in a democratic country of having this very direct line of communication with the population?
Well, first of all, I didn't really bother too many people in the government because they were used to me. So that wasn't a problem. I mean, there were some people who were perhaps a little conservative. I don't mean left or right, but just didn't like, you know, one does not do this as president. Whereas, you know, when you're a president of such a small country, if you want to get a message out, if you're going to simply rely on your diplomats to deliver aides memoir and demarches, maybe there are better ways of commenting on things. And so people got used to it, I guess. And again, aside from some people who thought it inappropriate, but I mean, there were other people who thought this was precisely what one should do in the modern era. And if you're going to be a digital country, then why would you refrain from using the new medium? And I started in 2009. So that's, I mean, people have gotten quite used to me now.
Did you ever do a rollout of a public policy position on Twitter back then?
Well, not quite. I mean, there would be public policy positions that I would then retweet, I mean, or I would put out a link to something. But I never thought of it as being such a big deal. Primarily, it is a news source for me.
But when you see Donald Trump using his Twitter account himself, do you see that as a sort of bizarre transmogrification of what it was that you were doing? Or is it just something that's different in kind? As in, if you imagine a sane, decent man as president of the United States who's thoughtful and has things to say, should he be manning his own Twitter feed like you did? Or is the difference between a giant country and a tiny country enough to say that what you were doing simply has no application in the American presidency? Or is what we're watching just a distortion of the personality of Donald Trump?
Well, I don't see a reason an American president shouldn't tweet on things that he considers important, but following the broad guidelines of the policy that has been devised through the interagency policy. That sounds very bureaucratic, but basically, I mean, I never tweeted anything that would have gone against what the government thought. I mean, different ministries or the
For example, endorsing my fight against Putin.
Right.
Right. Like you actually had the discipline to say whatever my personal thoughts about that. I did notice you endorsed it after you got out of office, but
that's different. I mean, now I'm a free agent.
But I mean, the point is that you were exercising discretion and you were saying, okay, this would not be a good idea. There was nothing impulsive about your Twitter feed.
Well, occasionally, but in general, yes. I mean, if I got riled up.
But it probably didn't change the whole course of a country's political position on a topic.
No, clearly not. Well, I don't know how much the tweets of President Trump have changed the political position of the country. I mean, he does fire people via Twitter, but in general, I mean, the broad policy, at least in foreign and defense affairs, seems to run its own semi-independent course. I mean, they're not that tightly tethered.
So we wanted to ask you a few questions about Russia and our upcoming election in the midterm and get your thoughts. I'll ask you a super broad question. Is Russia going to try to interfere in the American midterm election?
Well, they're interfering as we speak in the general political process. Nothing has really changed except perhaps the intensity. But I mean, if you see all along since the 2016 election, Twitter bots, trolls, I remember, I mean, beginning already with the first Syria missile, suddenly you saw this upsurge in Twitter activity, you know, sort of major fake pseudo-domestic Twitter bots tweeting anti-Comey messages last year when Comey testified, anti-Mueller tweets. So they are, I mean, this is a continuous process. The idea that it's just the election that they are involved in is silly. Of course, an election gives you more opportunity to do other things that you can do only during elections, such as, well, sort of attacking voter rolls, for example, which we now... Well, depending on who you listen to, either the Department of Homeland Defense says that 21 states had their voter rolls breached, and then the oddly named Ms. Reality winner, who then leaked NSA documents, said that there were 39 states where voter rolls were breached. And even if they did not do anything or change anything, the mere fact of a breach is enough to sow confusion, to doubt about the legitimacy of the election. So you don't really have to do much. So I think we will be seeing things on that order, certainly. And then, you know, the Twitter bots basically were big attacks, but I mean, spreading fake news, maybe, I mean, they're slightly hobbled by having a number of sites taken down now on social media, but you can always make new sites. Certainly what I am worried about most in the kind of social media sphere is creating fake groups. We saw with I guess in Texas, where you have a white nationalist group that is has lots and lots of members or followers or friends or whatever you call them on Facebook, but is actually created by the Internet Research Agency in Petersburg. And then you have a pseudo-black act or Black Lives Matter group, called, which they call Blacktivists, and which are followed by black people. And then you organize a demonstration by the two of them in the same place at the same time. I think that was clearly done in the hope of creating some kind of confrontation. Those kinds of things are, they're forms of active measures that really could not have been done before the digital era, which I kind of place really in a big way in 2006, when you had two things happen. One is the smartphone came out and is used ubiquitously, and then the rise, and then social media. I mean, they fed each other, I think. And but I mean, you can't walk around this campus or a European campus or a bus or a mall or, I mean, any place in the world that I've been in the last several years, you walk around and people are either, they're eating looking at their phones or they're walking looking at their phones. And what are they doing? I mean, unless they're simply sending messages to their friends, they're probably looking at Facebook or Twitter or something. And so you have this audience reach that never existed back in the 80s, when there were active measures designed to convince the world the U.S. had invented AIDS or the CIA invented AIDS. I mean, things that never went anywhere because of the lack of propagation.
Pulling back a little bit, you're obviously in a great position to talk about the transitions Russia has gone through in trying to sow discord in the West, starting in Estonia in the mid-2000s. Have you seen them take transitory steps in how they're trying to sow discord? And does that lead you to think that if we do get a handle on the things they're trying to do with social media and all this stuff, what would their next step be after this?
Well, I would date it back further. I mean, we already saw in Estonia, when the Estonia, Latvian, Lithuanian independence movements began to really take off before our independence, that the Soviets then were already saying, oh, these are a bunch of racist nationalists and they're going to start killing Russians if they become independent. And would then, at that time, I mean, they tried to manipulate various audiences. I remember Mary Dayevsky in the London Times was especially eager to spread Russian stories that were fake, but mainly with diplomats. And I remember in the 90s when I was ambassador in Washington, where, I mean, there would be utterly silly, ridiculous stories, and then I'd be called up and asked to explain things that were made up. So that was working then, but it wasn't really very effective in that, I mean, they were, I guess, just learning. The Russians realized that in the 2008 war with Georgia, that they were killed on the public communication, strategic communication side. They had paid no attention to it, just went in, and then they realized that public opinion in the West was clearly against the Russians, which didn't really matter much ultimately in terms of EU policy towards Russia, because they kind of shrugged it off as a one-off, but be that as it may, they realized they really blew that one, and they undertook a fairly broad renovation of their whole military approach, which included not only, you know, sort of having much better equipment and spending much more money on that, but also on the communication side of things. And so when we saw Crimea, you saw really the targets were target audiences aside from their domestic audience, were really Western journalists. And I think Michael Weiss and Peter Pomerantsev put out a paper in 2014, sort of August, that described this, which was really a new phenomenon that took advantage of, say, you know, some complete and utter lie, you know, so it's, you know, about a child, a three-year-old being crucified by the Ukrainians that had no base in fact, and then it's being debunked. Then it's picked up, for example, very often by BBC. So they say, well, on the one hand, we have this story, and then we have, on the other hand, we have this other story. And we see to this day, I mean, there are, I mean, if you have this idea that we're going to be balanced and you simply repeat, you know, blatant lies, and then you say, well, there must be a middle ground. Well, there is no middle ground between the truth and a lie. I mean, it's, and there they were quite successful and managed to convince lots of people, even members of the U.S. Congress. They were dealing with a bunch of Nazis there and in Ukraine and so forth. So this, that was, I would call, the breakout of Russia's propaganda machine into mainstream Western journalism that previously had not taken place. And, of course, using all kinds of mechanisms. Such, I mean, there's the crisis actor. There really are crisis actors, not the ones that whatever his name is talks about in InfoWars.
Alex Jones.
But, you know, the Ukrainians have found, you know, the same woman being a different crying victim in all these different places, you know, sort of Crimea, Slavansk, Donetsk. She's always playing this certain role, but it's the same person. I just saw recently that she'd appeared in Latvia. So
the whole, when you bring this to the intervention in the U.S. election through the means of hacking, through the means of the social media distribution, it brings together a clash of at least three different major themes of your career that I can think of: liberalism and its response to authoritarianism, Russia, and tech and cybersecurity.
Right. And this was, in fact, that's what I tell people. I mean, you know, like, suddenly all the three strands of my life came together. I don't know if that's a good thing or not. They were fairly distinct, sort of. I mean, every once in a while there'd be some overlap. But with the 2016 election, now as we realize that across the liberal democratic world and in sort of retroactively, probably in Brexit with all this coming out, and probably with a Dutch referendum that took place a year before the U.S. election, that this is a practice that has been developed over time, but it does bring it all together. I mean, and it brings me to the question, I mean, this is what I ponder and try to write about, is, I mean, what is the fate of liberal democracy in the digital era? Again, that, which I said, sort of begins around 2006 when you have this massive spread of the technology and of social media. And it's not clear. I mean, I have some thoughts, which are probably not very popular, but I can go into that.
Sure. I mean, I want to start, before we go into the sort of fate of liberal democracy, I'm interested in how you evaluate the threat. People talk about Putin's motivation as sowing chaos or bringing discredit. You've dealt with him. How do you evaluate who he is and what he's trying to do?
Well, I mean, I think the goal is not simply to sow discord. I mean, that's kind of the standard line. Okay, he's just doing this.
He's a chaos muppet.
To show his domestic audience that those people aren't any better. Actually, he knows they're better. The greatest defense of the West is rule of law. And rule of law, not in a philosophical sense, but the state cannot arbitrarily take your money away from you. So the West must exist for Russia, because even his money is laundered in the West. But you can't just take someone's money away here. And so it's not in his interest to actually bring down the West. It's in his interest to have Russia-friendly governments. Governments that would veto an Article 5 vote in NATO, that would not sanction Russia in the face of bad behavior. And, you know, he's done a fairly good job of this. I mean, look at Austria, look at the Czech Republic, look at Greece. I mean, they basically grumble and a lot, actually, about these things and won't go along with it. Austria didn't go along with expulsion of diplomats. In fact, Austria, about 10 years ago, found a KGB man who was wanted for the murder of 13 Lithuanians. And even though they had been picked up by the border guard, they let him go with the intervention of the ambassador from Russia. So he wants to have governments that are pliant but do have rule of law. And if you look at where he's intervened, people here, I read comments saying, well, he intervenes on the sides of authoritarians. Well, that's true, but I think he intervenes much more on the side of political parties and politicians that would adopt a soft line regarding Russia, be it Marine Le Pen or Milos Zeman. I mean, if you look at Zeman, I mean, he's not even really hardcore right or left-wing populist. He's just very pro-Russian.
Dana Rohrabacher.
Well, who claims to be a Reagan sort of, I fought in Afghanistan, but to have, I mean, he would like to see governments adopt a friendly, soft attitude towards Russian bad behavior in what he deems his sphere of influence. That certainly includes at least 12, if not 15, of the republics of former republics of the Soviet Union. And certainly in sort of the look at the platform of the Republican National Committee in 2016, which went a rather amazing transformation at the insistence of Paul Manafort, where he saw a party that traditionally had been very tough on Russia for meddling in various affairs and going to having a platform that didn't really say anything.
Now, if that's the external threat actor, how do you describe the fate of liberal democracy threat that is partly a function of that, but also partly a function of internal chaos within the various countries?
Well, I would say that, I mean, the not-so-great conclusion I'm reaching is that if you look at the different mechanisms employed that undermine democracy, that two core concepts are incompatible. One is free and fair democratic elections with rule of law, constitutional rights, and anonymity. It is anonymity that has allowed, first of all, or enabled the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg or domestic trolls to go after people. And, you know, the bullying that goes on, I just read another piece just an hour or so ago about, you know, this same InfoWars guy, whatever his name is. I've never watched it, but the Sandy Hook massacre, I mean, the parents of these kids were trolled heavily. I mean, of the kid who'd lost their children. And so they just initiated a class action suit against him. But all of these things are enabled, this horrible trolling that has gone on. I mean, it's not just the United States, but it's possible only through maintaining anonymity. And I think that when we live in an era in which you really don't, it really is the New Yorker cartoon, you know, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. And the follow-up to that from the Snowden period in the New Yorker is, everyone knows you're a dog. It's not true. You don't know who they are. I mean, in fact, if you look at what the NSA did, all they did was map connections. They did not know who is who. They did not do deep packet inspections it's too hard to do. They're looking at who's connected to whom. The anonymity is just incompatible with open discourse. I mean, I think you'd say whatever you want, but, I mean, people should know who it is that's saying it.
Counterpoint to that, though, I really would only see authoritarian regimes being the ones that enforce openness on the internet because they'd want to know who's saying what.
Well, I know. I always hear that. And I say, you know, it's ultimately too bad. We have to defend our democracy, that we cannot allow ourselves to be destroyed because of authoritarian regimes in another way. That is okay, you know. I mean, I would say that with PRC, they know pretty well who's saying what's happening, even if you're anonymous. I mean, it's just to avoid that level of surveillance and sort of truly authoritarian regimes with the right technology would know anyway who's saying what. But we don't have the mechanisms to go after people, and we wouldn't want them. But we should want people to appear under their own name. So if they're going to start harassing the parents of children who are killed by some mass murderer, then you know who they are and you can use the sort of civil court system to go after them, if not the criminal.
So talk to us about CyberNATO.
Well, it doesn't exist. I would say, well, first of all, it's a misnomer. It's just this kind of a synecdoche for this idea that we need to do much, we need to cooperate much more when it comes to cyber, which has come out of years and years of experience that, I mean, if you look at, I mean, if you even take just the problem of liberal democracies being attacked, I mean, there are, we know that there are a limited number of actors who have attacked, the same actors have attacked across the Western world. I mean, APT-28, APT-29, Fancy Bear, Cozy Bear, however you want to call them, they've gone into not only the DNC, but Comey said the RNC, but they've gone into the Bundestag in Germany, they've gone into the German think tanks, they've gone into the Italian foreign ministry. I mean, this goes on and on everywhere they've gone into. I mean, it's not just countries. They go into WADA or the World Anti-Doping Agency, doxing things where necessary. I mean, the big fear, of course, with a lot of the hacks is that you get doxed, which is a new phenomenon. But that's, we can talk a little bit about that later because I think it represents a change in journalism. But so they're all over the place. But, it's, I mean, two main actors, right? And Guccifer is tied to one of them. And then you have the Internet Research Agency. So, I mean, I'm not discounting the possibility there are other ones, but you have three big sort of actors that are involved in meddling in elections, meddling in sort of democratic institutions, international organizations. Yet the response is strictly national. Each country says, okay, well, what are we going to do about this? And if we look at the places that are threatened by this, it's not only the countries of NATO. I mean, we see similar activity in non-NATO countries. We see similar activity in non-EU countries. General McMaster said in December that the Russians are now hitting the Mexican election in favor of Obrador, one of the candidates, who's more anti-American. I mean, kind of makes sense. So what we need is to dramatically increase the amount of cooperation. And the reason why I say NATO is the wrong term for it is that NATO is a pre-digital era security organization where back when force still sort of relied on the classic formula of force, which is mass times acceleration, that's force. It's kinetic. Rockets, bullets, they move from one place to another, and then they kill people. Ever since the first pre-hominid threw a rock at another pre-hominid, use of force has been kinetic. It's no longer the case because basically mass times meters per second squared, the meters part or the feet part, has been eliminated from the equation. Distance has become irrelevant. You can attack countries around the world instantaneously and regardless of distance. NATO is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization because it's based on sort of fighter plane range, bomber range, tank logistics, placement of troops, but it doesn't matter anymore. Distance in this kind of war, this kind of fight, has lost its importance. So there's no reason why Japan, South Korea, New Zealand, Australia shouldn't be involved in an alliance that would, in fact, share information about these kinds of things, which right now happens minimally. I mean, aside from the Five Eyes, there's not really much information sharing. But I think that as more democracies come under threat, this may be a way to go. I mean, you know, both John McCain and Madeleine Albright, each of them proposed in the 90s something called either a community of democracies or a league of democracies. And that didn't go anywhere. Neither one went anywhere because I don't think that democracies didn't feel under threat like that in the 90s. I mean, we were on a roll. We were like getting better. We're moving forward. Right now, as we see the democracy receding, maybe we'll pay a little more attention to these kinds of issues.
So as you're thinking about this, though, whether it be a NATO structure or a League of Democracies structure, that you have these cyber units coming together and sharing information, NATO wasn't, in some ways, it was material, it was physical, it was kinetic. But it was also massively psychological. It was about deterrence. It was about pushing a threat and making that adversary think that they'd have a bad response if they pushed against this united front. Would you see a cyber NATO or League of Democracies having that additional element of deterrence and psychology?
Well, not necessarily in the cyber domain. I think one of the things we really need to understand, and I see a lot of sort of bad discussion where people don't understand this, is that in this attack on democracy, the attacker has an asymmetric advantage. You're not, no matter what you do, I mean, even if you manage to get 97% of the Russian population to actually vote for Vladimir Putin, he is still going to win with 74% of the vote, no matter what you do. I mean... So, I mean, you're not going to, I mean, what are you going to do? You're not going to do troll farms. I mean, I guess you can hack and dox, but that doesn't really have much of an effect either. I mean, really where the response comes in is in those things where the asymmetric advantages for democracies. Well, I mean, sort of rule of law. You don't allow any more shell companies to buy property anonymously. I mean, that would already be a big blow. Sanctioning people who you know have done bad things is another thing that you can do. Now, the reason why you need some kind of coordination is that if it's just done by some countries and not others, then that really isn't effective. You have to do it across the sort of the democratic rule of law world, which I think is, I mean, it's hard to achieve, but I think something like that can be done as centrist liberal democratic governments begin to worry about losing power to extreme left or right populists. And I think that is a genuine worry in many countries that, you know, this could go bad. And if you see the Russians participating in sort of working against you, that I think that has turned countries around. Certainly, I think Macron, having been doxed, I mean, his response is quite tough. I think that, you know, other countries I know are quite worried about these outcomes. Of course, other countries where the populists come in, maybe not so. They think it's great that they won. And this is a question. I don't see much political action on actually defending the elections coming up in the midterm here. And maybe there are some people may actually be hoping, well, I hope the Russians help us because, you know, otherwise, you know, we may not get reelected. I wouldn't say that, ascribe that to anyone. But I mean, certainly you can see in countries that there would be those people that are completely happy. I mean, Marine Le Pen. So, you know,
yeah, she didn't seem to mind.
No, she got $10 million from a sanctioned bank.
So I'm interested in the non-digital NATO, non-cyber NATO. You were the head of state of a country that's sitting there on Russia's border that has been attacked, albeit in a DDoS kind of way, and that has a large ethnic Russian minority, and the incorporation of which into the West does not seem to me in Putin's mind to be a matter that he has reconciled himself to. And we now have a president of the United States who has often raised questions about his own commitment to NATO, to our allies more generally, and has described the relationship between the countries under the U.S. security umbrella and the United States in terms that are frankly transactional. They need to pay. And so I'm interested in your perception of current frontline European, Eastern European attitudes toward the U.S. security umbrella. How confident are people that the United States will be there for them the day they're needed? And what are the consequences of the erosion?
Well, first of all, Secretary Bob Gates's valedictory speech, I guess, in 2010, something like that, actually warned European countries that the U.S. Congress will not tolerate a continuation of the Europeans not pulling their weight.
But you guys pulled your weight.
We did. Partially, I mean, when I read the Gates thing, then I basically sat down with the defense minister and said, look, you know, it may not be there yet, but there will come a time. I mean, his prediction turned out to be quite prescient. But by that, I mean, you could sense that this is something that is not tenable. And so we've been pulling our weight for a number of years at, well, 2% plus, actually, what they agreed upon. So that's our backstop. I mean, we've had a much easier ride in Estonia than other countries, the overwhelming majority of which do not, you know, sort of even come close. Well, I mean, this is where this comes in. This is this kind of schizophrenia that we notice. And I mean, U.S. policy, what is said and what the U.S. does are very different. I mean, the rhetoric on NATO already 2016, late spring, I remember. Well, you know, we're not going to, you know, this is obsolete and people don't pay their share. I mean, I remember I tweeted then that Estonia is proud to have for many years paid its share. Well, I mean, I guess it was a subtweet, you might say, but anyway, no. I didn't address anything directly. I just put that statement out there. But you don't know what, I mean, when you're at the Munich Security Conference, then either last year, Vice President Pence, or this year, National Security Advisor McMaster came out and reassured everybody the very strong U.S. commitment. And then you have other statements that reflect a different view. And the question is, what is it? This is the big question, is if push comes to shove, what will dominate? The kind of the standard, I mean, the strong commitment of the U.S. Security and defense establishment to sort of 70 years of, you know, everyone sort of working in one direction and with very little dissent. It's very strong bipartisanship regarding NATO, and which still exists. If you go to Congress, if you go to the Pentagon, or if you talk to security policy people, I mean, there's no change there. But and even if the vice president and the national security advisor are part of that sort of the mainstream view, then we have a president who is, to quote Ben Rhodes, outside the bubble.
And what about the average person on the street in Tallinn who is aware that, in a way that the average person on the street in Washington is not aware of Russia,
right?
The, you know, in countries that have a living memory of Soviet domination and that, you know, you don't have to go very far to see Russian troops, there is a presence in mind. And how does it affect people psychologically in terms of their own perceptions of their own security when they don't know whether to believe one United States or a different United States?
Well, I think for people in Tallinn, first of all, seeing is believing, is that you do have British troops and French troops, and they're in place. Not a lot, but, you know, when people say, well, there's so few, I say, well, I mean, there were even, do you think Berlin was defensible? I mean, the point is that NATO is here. And, you know, again, the standard argument, even here in the U.S., well, you know, do you think they could stop? Are they defensible? Well, I said Berlin wasn't defensible. The problem is if you had attacked Berlin then or, you know, Latvia today, you know, you have to worry about what's the fate of Murmansk, right? I mean, that's really the essence of Article 5 and why NATO is so hated, is Article 5 and collective defense and a response to aggression against NATO members. It's not something you're going to sort of fight out in one little place, but then it's across the board, which is why going after Ukraine or Georgia or whatever you want to go after, I mean, Moldova, not yet, but, or in, you know, hopefully not, those countries do not have that kind of security. So I wouldn't say people are nervous. And what's interesting is that, of course, the Russian media, domestic Russian media, has really been sort of saying, oh, war is going to start. They even have programs that are things to buy, take to your air raid shelters. And interestingly enough, including Estonian chocolate. But in any case, I mean, there was a program last week about what to take with you. I mean, talk about war mongering. I mean, they're really getting, I mean, I think for domestic political reasons, just getting their folks riled up.
Are they trying to scare folks, or are they really wanting to create discord internally?
Oh, I think they want to, first of all, scare folks in Russia, but it also, I mean, it does seep over into my country and Latvia and other places where people are heavily watch Russian language television programming, which I have to say is in its slickness, its infotainment, its kind of production values, vastly superior even to Hollywood. I mean, if you look at a Russian sort of news program, I mean, it is really, really well done. So it's obviously much more interesting than watching something boring like Estonian not to mention, you know, BBC television. None of it is as good as what they do. They're really masters.
Do we have a couple of minutes to ask about the new cyber defense unit, or the cyber command in Estonia that's just starting up? How is it going? And as compared to the volunteer
Well, unit, they're different things.
They are different they're things.
Very, I mean,
are they complementary?
Yeah, well, I mean, the National Guard, sort of the equivalent of the National Guard Cyber Defense League, is it was designed to solve a problem that affects basically every market economy, which is that the people who are in defense, they're paid much less than even most civil servants, and the people who are in IT get paid vastly more than most people in the private sector. So the idea was, like the National Guard, but instead of running around the woods a weekend a month, you get together on, you know, Tuesday or Thursday night and work on cyber issues, and you get all these, you know, people from sysadmins to geeks with ponytails to senior cybersecurity sort of experts. We'll get together and just work on stuff. I mean, you know, basically, you know, how do you defend against that? What do you do? How do you defend against that? Whereas on the military side, it's, I mean, the analogy is, I mean, there is a cyber command in the United States, which is located in Maryland, and you have our partner, National Guard for Estonia, is actually Maryland, and they took this idea, and they too have a National Guard unit. So it's very different. I mean, the National Guard people work on sort of technical problems. Cyber Command works on sort of, you know, what do you do if this happens or that happens?
One last thing. You guys, when you were president, you spent an enormous amount of energy digitizing the country of Estonia and the range of services that are provided online is astonishing. And you pioneered this notion of digital identity, which you made available to people who were not citizens of the country, including me. And my question is, in an environment in which liberal democracy is threatened, as you describe, by Russian actors and other actors, and the modality of the threat is often, but not exclusively, cyber attacks of one sort or another, is the highly digitized society, as you guys created it, more secure or more vulnerable as a result of a, on the one hand, very sophisticated set of digital identity infrastructure, but on the other hand, immense reliance on relatively cohesive unitary systems?
Well, first of all, I would say we're far stronger. I mean, I'm going to have to launch into a talk now, I mean, for you. So, I mean, basically, the Estonian system is based on a few principles that slowly are being adopted by at least Europe, that need to be adopted by countries like the United States, but I don't see any movement. First of all, I mean, as I mentioned before, in this world, without a secure, unique digital identity, you're open to all kinds of stuff because you don't know who someone is. A bank doesn't know who you are. I mean, if it's really something. And they have all these silly, I mean, you know, banking in the United States have all these kind of silly password and other mechanisms don't work, or they're based on form of two-factor authentication that works over a mobile phone. Unfortunately, the S7 protocol, which connects transmission towers, was hacked a long time ago. And in fact, already last year, a German bank lost, using mobile phone-based two-factor authentication, lost $3 million. So, I mean, you need a secure identity. You need to have it authenticated. It needs to be end-to-end encrypted. What you need to do furthermore, two things, it needs to be tied to one or another form of state-controlled registry. I mean, it could be, in our case, a national registry. In the case of California, it can be the people in the DMV. But something that provides you a legal identity anyway. So, you know, be it a passport. I mean, you have passports, you have driver's licenses. That's where how you prove your identity. Well, tie it to that registry, because then you can take the legal step. This is all your field, right? The legal step that is really necessary to enable all of the services that we have, which is you have a legal transaction whenever you, whether you get your prescription online or you register for something with, or you vote. I mean, they're all legal transactions. And that is the key step that is not taken by most countries, unfortunately. We did all that in 2001. And then the behavioral economics side of it is that even if you take that, what you need to do is make the identity universal and mandatory, at least for having one. You don't need to use your identity. You can do everything you want still on paper if you really want to, but no one does. But the thing is that the way both the private sector and the public sector, when it looks at the strong ID that we have, generally the system in countries where it's voluntary, like in Europe, you have an uptake rate of about 15 to 20%, the early adopters. And then you have 80 to 85% of the population doesn't have this ID. So from the perspective of the government or the administration or the banks or the private sector in general, go, why should I invest in developing a digital service if only 15% of the population is using it? Understandable. But in our case, since you know that everybody who's an adult has it, it's not just citizens. It's anyone who's a permanent resident of Estonia, so EU citizens living there, people who live in Estonia who have Russian citizens, they all have that. And what we then did was just decided to think about it, that since the identity is so strong and there's such, people call it KYC, know your customer. I mean, you have to be fingerprinted and, you know, you have to do a due diligence on the person that does this, that, what the hell? I mean, all it does is gives you the right to open a bank account and start a company. And certainly when people say, well, aren't you worried about money laundering? I don't think there's a single money launderer in the world who goes and voluntarily has himself fingerprinted in order to launder money. I mean, this is a problem.
But you're convinced that the aggregate security impact of having all this centralized infrastructure, that you're not creating a Fort Knox problem.
No. That's the other part, which I didn't get to, but that's because it's next step of that. It is a distributed data exchange layer. I would recommend going into YouTube and then typing in X Road long version, and the long version is 3 minutes, 30 seconds. But it is that every transaction is between one server and you and another server. There is no central database. So, in fact, the principle is the opposite of a Fort Knox. It's the principle is of a ship that has all of these holes. And they're all the doors are closed. So if you actually do, it hits a rock or someone shoots a torpedo at it, it'll only flood one compartment, yours. I mean, that's what gets, but it doesn't affect, you can't have a massive data breach because that requires a different interaction with a different identity with different, I mean, this is why it's the antithesis of a centralized database. And every time, it's also highly regulated so that, you know, certain people have permissions to look at certain things but not others. So, for example, the social welfare agency can look at your health records to see whether it is you're justified in getting some kind of thing from the social welfare agency, but it can't look at anything else. I mean, all of these things, I mean, it requires a huge amount of work to get the regulatory side of this done. But ultimately, the essence of the system is not. It's not technological. I mean, there are certain bare essentials you need technologically to get this done. But it really comes down to political will, policy that comes out of the political will, laws that are created by a policy that has been adopted by a government, and finally, and often, sort of the slowest thing you can do is the regulation that gets all of this working properly, because the laws don't specify the exact nature of it.
And you think you're confident that at the end of the day, liberal democracy in Estonia under attack is stronger as a result of this system than it would be absent it, or that it is in countries that are not yet that advanced as digital democracies.
We've taken certain precautions. I mean, in fact, we have negotiated a bilateral or several, but one in that is coming into has come into effect, bilateral treaty extending the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Immunity and Extraterritoriality to servers. And so we actually have everything that we have in Estonia is duplicated in a series of servers in Luxembourg. The idea being, well, if we get invaded, we still exist in a server government in exile. Well, I mean, this becomes crucial when, in fact, you want to see property records. Then, who's a citizen? I mean, who's there legitimately? Who's not? And what we've also done, just for the security people, is that we've put all of the crucial databases on distributed ledger, or I hate to use the term blockchain, same thing, but you have the blockchain of ice cream today. Everything is blockchain, but so crucial.
It's about to save coffee, by the way.
So property records, health records, even, and for Lawfare listeners, even court cases, because our court case, we no longer print big fat law journals with court cases, and it's all digital. But if you think about it, I mean, since the real issue is data integrity, we can talk a little bit about that. But if someone goes and changes a court decision made, say, 7 years ago, and then you're looking for, okay, now you have a new case, and wasn't there this case of, Wittes versus the Republic of Estonia, and didn't they decide that? And you go back and go, wait a minute, oh, they decided something different. I thought I didn't remember that. But so we put court cases also all on blockchain. And I would say, since we're running out of time, that what I would wish that people, when we talk about all these digital things, would worry far more about data integrity and far less about privacy, because privacy is obviously important. But privacy is when someone, for example, would publish my blood type, or they'd publish my bank account. I mean, blood type, I mean, the bank account would be kind of embarrassing, but, in its
current state,
how small it is, but, But if someone changes my blood type, the record of my blood type, and I go to a hospital and they say, oh, he's got, type B, but in fact, I don't, that could be fatal. I mean, I can just think of all kinds of examples. And really, data integrity is really the big issue that that companies and countries need to address. And that's not yet addressed by GDPR, which we haven't talked about at all here. But anyway, maybe next time.
On that cheerful note, Tomas Ilves, thanks for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Stanford University for making its studio available to us. Our music is, as always, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And if you haven't yet done your part to tweet the Lawfare Podcast, share it on Facebook, and give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast services you use, you are not doing your part, because we don't advertise and we don't have, major companies behind us. We've only got you. And of course, as ever, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.